This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about body image and disfigurement. So before we get into the interview with this week's guest, I'm going to start off with a definition. The word disfigurement is used to describe the aesthetic effects of a mark, rash, scar or skin graft on a person's skin or paralysis to the face or body. Disfigurement can affect anyone at any time, any age, from any ethnic group, whether from birth, accident, disease or aftermath of surgery. So that definition I found really useful as a great general description of disfigurement and all the things that quite broad term can mean. So we've also got some statistics on the types of disfigurement people experience and how common they are. So these stats are from Changing Faces, the body image charity. So first off, 1,345,000 people in the UK have a significant disfigurement to their face or body. And significance is taken into account in regard to visibility, extent, and location on the body. So that first off means 1 in 44 people in the UK have experienced or currently experience body disfigurement. So how do you feel about that information so far?
I mean, it's just something that you don't, I suppose, think about. 1 in 44?
It's a lot.
It's a lot of people.
You know, if I think of going to the theatre, how many people are in that room? If I think of like going to New Street Station, how many people standing around watching the monitors? And what is so difficult, I think, as people will hear in the interview, is that there's so many ways in which disfigurement can affect people that it's not always obvious. Even though this is something to do with people's outside body, it can be in areas that you don't see, or it can be in ways that you don't initially notice. And that may seem easier, but that's not necessarily the whole story. Certainly for our guests, having the ability to cover certain things up actually meant it was more complicated for her. It was more of a choice to be open about who she is, how she looks, what her past experiences have been, which again, I think is something that we often don't consider if these issues don't affect us.
Absolutely, Bobby, you've hit the nail on the head. That was the most extraordinary and interesting and inspirational thing I heard about the whole interview. She was amazing, wasn't she, to start with?
Yes.
We absolutely loved Sylvia, because I would just never have thought of it like that until she really expressed that. You know, everybody feels differently about whatever it is that they're dealing with, which we all know. But when you really look into it and hear her talk about her story and how she found it harder because she covered up. So people might perceive, well, you had scars on your back, a lot of scars on your back. But I've got a massive birthmark on my face. So it's worse for the person that's got the birthmark on the face, because everybody, they have no choice about people seeing it. She's got a choice to cover it up so she could live day to day, nobody knowing. For her, that was so much worse, because every day she was covering it up. Every time she met somebody, she had to decide when she might tell them. Any relationships she got into, going swimming, which she loved, all of the things that we take for granted, she thought about on a daily basis, the pain that she was in, but then not being able to talk to anybody about it. But the extra work that she had to do and how she struggled with that. From a mental health point of view, that was the absolutely most poignant part. So interesting to listen to her talk about it in that way.
And so much of that even is really universal, whether you're experiencing any kind of disfigurement or whether it's to do with body image in other ways, whether it's to do with your weight, whether it's to do with any kind of body dysmorphia, eating disorders like you mentioned. There's so many factors that can build up shame in us around how we look, and that can contribute to, and even in extreme cases, cause mental illness. And so I'm really so delighted to be covering this topic, as you say, with such an inspiring guest to speak to. So just before we talk a little bit more about Sylvia, I've got some more stats about different types of disfigurement, also again from Changing Faces, the charity. So 66,000 people in the UK have disfigurement from accidents such as burns and facial scars. A further 40,000 have cancer-related disfigurement, including from surgery with skin cancer. Also, disfigurement can be caused by facial paralysis from a stroke, for example, or skin conditions like psoriasis, vitiligo, or acne. So there's so many different types of conditions that can cause or fit under the body disfigurement label of that 1 in 44 that we spoke about earlier. And some of these stats were really interesting to me because certain conditions like vitiligo, which is where your skin loses its pigment generally in patches, is something that I'd never even considered as a disfigurement. I'd always thought of it as it's just its own soul condition that people go through. But actually, in terms of how it can affect people's perception of themselves, how it can affect how comfortable they feel in their body, does share these parallels with so many other conditions that affect how we look. So that was really interesting to me to see how many different examples there were and why, again, this topic is so important. Because as if some things like mentioned there, like having a stroke or experiencing cancer, aren't bad enough, if you're then left with physical scars as a result of that, that's a whole other level of something to work through and something that so often there's not enough support for. And that's certainly something that came through talking to our guest, Sylvia, that while she got a lot of help with her experiences in terms of her physical body, in terms of her mental health, the services were severely lacking. And having heard her story, I would even go as far as to say they had even more impact in terms of the long term.
Absolutely. It was just not made aware. We're just trying to deal with the physical injury. We don't really need to deal with, you know, the mental health side of it until it's become, like you said, came to be at its worst. But there was, it had to be spoken about. But just as we've, you know, we speak about that shame and reducing the stigma and talking about it more, because it's a visual thing, the visualization of some of the illnesses, diseases, or, you know, defects, birth defects that people have, need to be made more public so we can see it out in our, you know, public domain. And, you know, I think we spoke about Winnie Harlow, that the Victoria's Secret model, she has vitiligo. Mm-hmm. And just to make, and she's just been so public with it, and she's in a bikini walking down the catwalk, and she's got vitiligo quite a lot across, you know, her whole body. And that kind of awareness is so crucial to, again, raising that awareness, talking about it, and then hopefully reducing the stigma around it. And, you know, and obviously hoping to help more people not fall into, you know, having mental illnesses because of it.
Yeah, because it's very difficult to hear about experiences like this where people are feeling shame and even experiencing discrimination due to something they have no control over. There's actually so many parallels in terms of how mental illness is so often discriminated against there. It's not something somebody chooses, and yet often it can be treated as if it is, that it's something you chose, it's something that's fair game for other people to pick on.
Mm.
And there's nothing fair about that. So I'm so glad to be covering this with Sylvia Mack. She's an incredible body image advocate. She's involved in all kinds of exciting campaigns, which she'll talk about a little bit in the episode. And
I mean, she's stripping off in city centres, isn't she, in a bikini, in a swimming costume, waving and flying the flag for all different body types and all that kind of stuff. I'm so excited. Absolutely love Sylvia Mack. So inspirational. I'm so excited. Sorry, Bobby, I just can't contain myself. Fantastic interview. Yeah. Amazing woman.
She's brilliant. And it's an inspiring interview. It's also, I feel, one of our most emotional.
Mm.
And certainly there's one part which you'll know it when it gets to it, where we were all getting teary-eyed in the room listening to that. I myself had a good cry listening back to it when going through the final edit for the episode. At the time, I was really focused on making sure she was okay and she was comfortable. But I'm so glad that she was able to share her experience so openly and so honestly. It really made me think about elements of how we view ourselves that I'd never even considered before. So I think this will be a fascinating episode to listen to. It is emotional, but it's ultimately inspiring. So we'll get into the episode with Sylvia in just a moment, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name's Sylvia Mack. I'm a childburn survivor. At the age of 3, I had quite a bad accident where I was severely disfigured for an accident at home. I was running around with my siblings and one of my elder siblings pushed a door and I fell back into the boiling water that was placed on the bathroom floor, causing third and fourth degree burns. I was taken to a local hospital that had no sort of amenities for people that had burns and literally said that there wasn't nothing they could do. And then I was then quickly sent on blue lighted all the way to Mount Vernon Hospital, which was miles away from home in Middlesex. And I was put on life support machine where I stayed for 10 days and nobody actually saw the disfigurement on my back. So nobody actually see how severe it was because I was laid on my back. Apparently I was laid on ice. I don't know how true that is, but I was told that. And then was given my last rites and my parents were told that I wouldn't survive the night. The next day I pulled through. So I'm here to tell my story of survival and my journey of mental health.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And so between you having the accident and you actually getting to the hospital that could treat you, how long did that take?
They had the police blue light us all the way to the hospital, which was miles from home. It was actually in Middlesex, so I live in London, mm-hmm. So you can imagine the journey was probably quite long, but quite quick being with the ambulance and the police. So yeah, as soon as we got there, I was put on life support, and then 10 days later, when they finally lifted me up to turn me over, my parents were presented with a massive hole in my back and were told to just be quiet, otherwise they, you know, just not to upset me.
Wow.
Yeah. It's quite severe.
Yeah, well, even, you know, even just how long it took you to get support from a hospital that could deal with the burns is, with you living in London, you yeah. just assume a city yeah. of that size.
Yeah, well, the accident happened in 1972, I believe, 1972. So it's quite a long time ago. And the local London hospital didn't actually have facilities for burns, mm-hmm. but they do now. And there are other hospitals in and around London that do sort of facilitate for people with burns and scarring. And in fact, one of the hospitals that I now go to is in West London. And so obviously they needed to send me quickly to somewhere else. Otherwise, there was no chance of survival for anyone that had any type of burn injuries as severe as what I did as a baby.
Yeah. Do you know at the time how much you were aware of what had happened to you?
No, I don't actually remember my accident at all. It's only what I've been told from my siblings and from my parents. Having a very supportive family has been great throughout my life, but trying to accept the way you look is something very different. And it's been a life of self-body hating, depression and suicidal thoughts at the worst mm-hmm. for me. Mm.
Yeah, that's really hard to hear, and particularly what you said earlier about your parents being told to be quiet as to not upset you. Because from that, you know, that young age, you're unlikely to remember a lot of your experiences. So it's, I don't know, it sort of screams a bit of naivety to me a little bit that they were encouraged in any way to shield you from your reality, from what you'd been through.
Yeah, it was quite strange, actually, because I know, you know, nowadays we're kind of encouraged to support in every way that we can. But it seemed to me that there were a lot of different things that were going on when I was younger. And I remember, for example, hospital appointments and having to stand on hospital beds for the staff to come in. And these were staff that were training, so like student doctors. They'd wear these long white coats and they'd come in and literally I'd be naked on this bed and they'd be turning me around to sort of inspect my body. I was a bit like a guinea pig, really, because it was unusual for a child so young to survive something so severe, but also to have a bodily disfigurement. Normally, children will pull kettles down and pots and it'll be on their arms mm-hmm. and their hands and faces. And so to have something severe on your back, they wanted to really look into that and research it more. But using me as a guinea pig and I'm sorry to use those words, but that's how I felt sort of throughout the years, all the way up to my teens. I was still going to hospital until I said, no, I'm not doing this no more. And then going back home and having to, you know, go through nightmares, waking up screaming, seeing doctors in, you know, white coats and stuff like that. It was quite traumatizing for me growing up and, you know, just going through all that. And there was much worse things going on as well, you know, all the way to bedwetting for many years that happened to me. And, you know, when people thought that I was holding my tummy because I was in pain from periods, I was holding my tummy because I was in pain from the scarring. But it was just something that I found easy to just say, you know, yes, I'm having period pains like you, but when I actually wasn't, I was probably bedwetting, and it's not something that I've addressed or spoken about, but I'm happy to talk about it now. It's just part of my body acceptance and my journey.
In particular, it sounds incredibly dehumanising the way you were brought in and again and again for the purpose of training junior doctors, as opposed to actually needing to be there for your own health. I can imagine that really could have interfered with, you know, how you see yourself and how you feel treated as a human as opposed to an object to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that. And although most of the time I'd be taken off to be spoken to about maybe having more skin releases or more skin grafts, I always had to go through the old journey of, okay, you're going to be seen by student doctors today. Mm-hmm. And it was something that I almost had to do. Yeah. And it was a shame that maybe my mum wasn't strong enough to just say, no, that's not going to happen no more. Because I remember holding my mum's hand and going to the hospital appointments and saying, I really don't want to do this. And she'd be, it'll be over soon, don't worry, you know, because she knew that she wanted me there for a reason to get treated. And it wasn't just to be looked at by all these doctors. But unfortunately, that's what happened.
Luckily, medicine's moved on a lot now, but it's so incredible to hear that wasn't so long ago, really, that you've had that experience. And it's particularly hard to hear how it changed your perception of the hospital, the place where you should have felt safe, where you should have felt comfortable and that you could go for help with your experiences, was instead somewhere that scared you, somewhere that you were having nightmares about.
Yeah, and I think that it just become sort of reality, and it was something that I did have to accept. And I did kind of accept in this bubble in my head that was going on, and because I was a child, and it become kind of okay. And it wasn't something that I could go, oh, this, something's not right here, this is wrong. It just become okay because they were the same people that were treating me and treating my scarring. So to me, it was fine for them to do that. Although I realise now that these were the reasons why I was suffering, just because of having to go through that.
Yeah, and that really highlights the responsibility of medical professionals, because they're setting the tone for what's appropriate. You as a young person, all the professionals that you were looking up to as experts were saying this was okay, but actually it was convenient to their objectives.
Yeah, and I understand, you know, that they do need to do this kind of stuff, but maybe they need to, that back then, maybe have looked at things in a different way and not been so severe with the way that they treated me or treated others, because I have spoken to other burn survivors who were burnt back in those years, and they just said, you know what, hey, I've been through that too. So I know that it wasn't just me back then. There were other people that were going through it too.
Yeah, you know, that experience affected so much of your life. Mm. So do you mind sharing a little bit more of how it did change your view of your body, both the accident and the treatment you received?
I kind of remember being in hospital quite a bit, having lots of surgery. I had lots of skin releases and skin grafts, and I remember my actual file being pushed out on a trolley on its own. And I used to say to my mum, there it is, mum, you know, that's my file. I used to feel almost proud to see it come out because it was so big, and it was bigger than anyone else's file, which is quite funny, really. But, you know, God knows how big the file is now today. But, yeah, so I continually had to have surgery and have the skin built up on my back. But at the same time, I had to have skin taken off the rest of my body. So my arms, the tops of my feet, my legs, it's a bit like scalping, really. That's the only way that I can describe it. And they take the skin off and they bandage it and unbandage it, treat it. And it was the sorest, most horriblest thing to go through. It was worse than the scar in itself, mm-hmm. because the scars would have been damaged by, would have been damaged and muscle and everything underneath my back. So I wouldn't really feel so much what was going on there, but I could feel everything else on my arms and my legs, and it was quite sore, and I had to go through this quite a lot. So yeah, I mean, as I got older and went to school, I mean, most of primary school I missed, and it wasn't until sort of my later years of primary school I began to spend more time at school, and I didn't really felt like I fitted in at all because I'd missed so much. And then when I got to secondary school, I remember my very first PE lesson, and I was asked to just join in with the activities, which I didn't really want to. And then I was told that I must go and shower. And this was something that I was not going to do because it meant undressing in front of other pupils. And this particular PE teacher, I'm not going to mention her name, it wouldn't be nice of me to do so, but she told me to get undressed anyway. And I had to because I was a child and there was nothing else I could do. She threw a towel at me. I covered up. And as we were lining up to go into the showers, I just was pleading with her that I didn't want to go in the shower. And she just pulled off the towel and pushed me in the shower in front of everyone. And I remember going home that day and saying, "Mum, I don't want to do PE anymore." So that impacted for the rest of my school life with PE. It was something that I didn't want to do.
I think you've raised something so important there that I think a lot of people wouldn't understand about being a burn survivor is the repeat trauma that you experience. That it's not just the initial burns, but it's also how that recovery process works. You're continually having to go through surgeries and then they're traumatic and then you're also having to recover from them. Yeah. And then you're also getting these social factors due to the severity of your disfigurement as well. So, it, you know, it's just building layer on layer of what you've had to go through.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't offered any type of counselling at all growing up. And people believe that, you know, you've got a loving family, great support, and there's so many people that go through traumas and childhood accidents and accidents in their lives where they have family support and a great family system. And we think, oh, well, that's enough, but it's not. And sometimes you just need someone else who might be going through something similar to you, who you can connect with. And that's something that I never had. So I always felt like I was that only person with scars, like the only person. And it was just so difficult. And I remember, like, the hospital also used to say, cover her up, cover up her scars. So my mum would cover me up in sort of long-sleeved, because, you know, she'd have to cover my arms and my legs too because of the skin grafts where they took skin. So I'd be fully covered in the sun on a beach holiday with the hat and the cream, and everyone else would be walking around in bikinis. So I could not feel like I fitted in with anyone. And then I remember one day a lady said to my mum, and it was a friend, she said, "It's a good job it's not on her face." And straight away I thought, well, that means this is ugly, so this is ugly. And I knew then that the whole of me was ugly. And so I looked at everyone else as beautiful. And I was basically the ugliest person in the world. That's the way I thought as a teenager and a young child growing up.
And it makes sense, you know, makes sense that you felt like that based on how you were being treated.
Yeah.
You know, they're constantly encouraging you to cover up. Well, of course you're going to build up shame around your own body.
Yeah.
And with all the medical intervention, I'm interested to know, did it always feel like your body? Because I know people that have gone through similar experiences talk about there's so much medical intervention that it can sometimes feel like it's not your body anymore.
I did kind of feel that I couldn't look at my scars. I know it's on my back, but I could have looked in a mirror. I've got scars on my leg and on my tummy, but I tried not to look at them at all. Just because I looked at it as I thought about it, that it was horrible or just something that wasn't part of me and it shouldn't be there. So I tried not to encourage myself to look in the mirror too often at my body. You know, I'd look at my face every now and again, but I wouldn't do that in school in front of other pupils because I'd automatically think, oh, I'm ugly and they're going to notice. And I just automatically thought that that's what they would think. Mm. But they didn't know. Most of them didn't know about my scarring. And maybe my best friend might have known. But other than that, nobody else knew. And so it was a bit of me just always doing this act where, for example, if I did PE, we wore short shorts and I'd put my arm down over my leg and I walked around with my arm over the front of my leg just so no one could see the scar down the front of my leg. And then, like I said, after lunch, my scars were so tight across my tummy, I could hardly eat. I was always a very thin girl and I couldn't eat too much. So I'd always sit on my own holding my tummy at lunchtime, but nobody knew what was going on. Teachers didn't know. And it was just something that I learned to deal with. And I think my parents were quite strong. You know, my father was one of these. I don't know if it's because he had five daughters, but he wanted us to be strong and, you know, and just get on with it, basically. It was like, come on, you can do this and get on with it. It was that kind of mentality that he had. They weren't trying to cover it up or anything. They're extremely loving, supportive parents. My mum was at every appointment. My dad was there. You know, so no badness towards them. They've been great parents, but it's just something that I've had to deal with. They did not know until I actually started to talk about it.
Yeah, and it sounds incredibly isolating in that you were constantly covering up. You know, that was the focus.
Yeah,
I can imagine for a lot of your life of how do I cover this up? How do I keep the secret, essentially?
Yeah. Well, this is what it was. It was, to me, a secret. And I know this almost sounds a bit strange, but it was like I've been acting all my life. It's like an act where I'm having to do things so that other people can't see what's going on. Or I can't make them aware that, oh, look, this is here and, you know, don't look at me. And I had to always do that. And all the way to, you know, doing swimming, for example, where I'd come out with a big towel and cover up and jump into the water when everyone was already in the water and then get out and run to the changing rooms and find a locker, you know, where I can just go and change on my own. And so it was constantly acting. And it was annoying because I just felt like I was alone sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that's what can be so powerful of what you mentioned before, talking to other people that have been through the experience.
Yeah.
Because if you're so busy acting around everyone else, you don't have that release of somebody that really gets it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't feel like even my closest sister, we spent a lot of time together and she was quite good at some point where she realised that I was being bullied and called names at the swimming baths and she'd step in and she'd always like be there for me. So she'd be a constant support. You know, I won't tell you what she said to the bullies, but I had some horrible names called like Lizard and Witch and it was just horrible to hear and knowing that this is it for me. And I remember one day watching Elephant Man and actually thinking, oh, you know, I actually compared myself to Elephant Man. And some people would think, but why? He had a really severe disfigurement. And yes, I have a severe disfigurement on my body, but I don't have it on my face. But I actually kind of wished it was on my face that then people could see me and say, ah, she's got a disfigurement. So covering this up just made it worse for me, if that makes sense.
No, that does make a lot of sense. And also, you weren't coming to terms with it yourself because you were covering it from everyone, including yourself. And you talked about, you know, even avoiding mirrors. I wonder if perhaps if it had been harder to cover, you would have spent more time perhaps getting used to it.
Yeah, I think so. It was ridiculous, really, that I couldn't even look at a mirror at home and just say, hey, you know, even to just have a quick look and see what's going on. But I just disregarded my scars. That's what it was. It was almost like I separated my scarring from my own inner self. And a lot of the way that I got through my life was talking self-talk in my head, and I'd constantly do that, and I've done it for so many years. I don't do it as much now because I prefer to just talk to anyone and everyone, but I spent a lot of time doing that.
Yeah, I imagine that was really helpful in just kind of motivating yourself to go through these difficult experiences. So as you were growing up, where was your mental health at?
There were different stages of my life where I would go from sort of low self-esteem. In school, I'd have really low confidence. So I'd sit at the back of the class and I'd be afraid to put my hand up, answer questions. I'd be afraid that anyone would come near me. So I'd literally have paranoia where I'd kind of move away thinking, oh, if they touch me, they're going to feel my scars. So I kind of went through that in school. And then later on, as I started to go into relationships, I found that extremely difficult because I felt like the need to have to sit down and explain to whoever I was going to be dating that I had scars on my body, because I had an experience where a boyfriend had run away from me when he found out I had scars. So that was really difficult. At the same time, my depression became quite severe and I began to drink quite a lot, and it was the only way that I could deal with it. And also, I kind of felt that because of the way that I felt about my body, especially in relationships, I was leaving myself open to the wrong type of partners. And it was something that can often be picked up on from the wrong type of people who would take advantage of you and make you feel worse about yourself, your own being. So that's why I try to help empower.
That's a really important concern to raise, because any kind of vulnerability can be targeted by abusers. You know, when you have people that are in relationships where they're the abusive partner, they generally choose a particular type of person. And it often does come down to confidence.
Yeah.
Because that's a way that they can take control.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you have low confidence, and they know the things they can say to drag you down.
Yeah, and I think that goes for anybody, really. Not just people with scarring or skin conditions. Yeah. It goes for anybody that has low confidence and don't feel good about their own bodies or their own selves. We leave ourselves open to this type of person. And it was something that I had to deal with. And unfortunately, it wasn't nice. And then later on, when I was job searching, the lacking confidence crept in. And I'd go to job interviews. I'd stand outside. I wouldn't actually go in to the job interview, then go home and say, hey, it was great. You know, it went really well. So I was lying quite a lot. I was also attacking my sisters and my family members, and this wasn't good. I was just really negative, such a negative person, which was a shame, because I felt like there was something in there that actually wasn't me. So after I'd attack everyone, and I don't mean attack, you know, physically,
verbally.
And then afterwards, I'd probably cry all night because I knew that wasn't the person that I wanted to be, but that was who I was at the time.
And so at this point, you'd not had any kind of mental health support?
I went through some counselling, but I actually approached the GP then.
That's interesting to hear, but I can really see where you were coming from, because you'd not had a huge amount of support, and so you'd not built up healthy coping mechanisms. And so often that does mean you go to anger or drinking. You know, these are all really common, whatever you're grappling with.
Yeah, I think they are. They're always these type of things that we sit down and think about. And I actually had suicidal thoughts at one point, and it come on along with the severe depression and where I was drinking quite a lot. And then I had times where I sat down and I just thought of loads of different ways that I could commit suicide. So it was always the thoughts, not me actually carrying anything out. But there was once a time when I had my daughter in the pram at the bus stop, and I literally was going to walk in front of a bus, but I turned around and looked at my daughter, and it was then I just thought, family is so much more important to me. Her face just made me think this isn't what you want for yourself or for your family. I don't want to put my family through something so severe as that when they'd already been through it when I was a baby, and I just need to do that to them. So it was always thinking about family as well. It just kept bringing me back to how supportive they were.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you had that to hold on to, really, to keep you continuing and surviving. I used to work at Samaritans, and so often that would be the conversation that people would be incredibly suicidal, really struggling to cope with day-to-day life. And it may just be one person that was keeping them there.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes that's what you need.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to hear, but I'm so glad that you had that in your life. You had that supportive family. Yeah. But it's also difficult to hear that you didn't get the support sooner.
Yeah.
And so, you know, whilst you'd had the physical support, your mental health just was quite neglected by the health service. And so when did mental health support come in eventually?
Around 1999, around that time, I'd approached a GP and I said, you know, I'm so depressed and I just don't feel right. And she said, have you thought about talking about your accident and maybe having some counselling? And I said, you know, let's do it. Let's try this then. And I went and I think I attended two or three sessions with the children and without, and it just didn't work for me. I know it works for other people, but I just didn't feel like I could connect, and whether they were the right people for me to connect with. So I ended up walking away from it.
And that's also challenging, you being there with your kids as well, because as a mother, your main focus is still going to be on them, potentially.
Yeah.
So I can imagine that made it a lot more difficult as well.
Yeah, it did. It definitely did, yeah.
And so what sort of age were your kids at that point?
I think my eldest was about 7, and then the other one was about 5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in terms of your family, in a broader sense, how much did your parents, for example, know about where your mind was at, what you were struggling with?
I don't think they really knew, just because a lot of my sort of, I say self-harm, I mean self-harm with alcohol, they didn't know that that's what I was doing.
Right.
So everything, like I said, everything was done over the phone, where I'd be horrible to everyone. I'd actually start a conversation which would be super nice, I'd be really nice, and then suddenly it would go downhill and then I'd start being really horrible. But I wasn't being horrible to them, talking about what had happened to me. It would just be about anything and everything, because I was so angry and I wanted to take it out on someone, but I didn't know why I was so angry. I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, you'd really had this built up of emotions and then nowhere to release it.
Yeah, I just couldn't recognise why I was behaving like this.
Yeah. And so what did it take then for you to gain more clarity on that?
I think it was just later on realising that I was crying every day, locking myself away in my bedroom, and my grandson had been born. He was living with my daughter, with me, and realised that what the hell am I doing, locking myself in a bedroom? Every letter that comes through the door, I think my paranoia was so, so severe that I thought every letter, every phone call was something terrible. I thought that someone was watching me and I didn't want to leave the house. So it was almost one of those things where it was easier to just stay in the bedroom locked away. But that was the time that I had to reflect and look and try and look for support online. And I couldn't find any support for people that had bodily disfigurement. And I realised, this can't be right, you know, you need to do something about this. Maybe you're the person that should be doing this. And then I remember just crying at the kitchen sink, thinking, I need to stop this. This needs to stop now. I've got a little grandbaby and I don't want to make them unhappy. I don't want them to see me crying. My son's growing up fast and I don't want him to see that. So it always come back to family that really helped change everything. But I did have a turning point in my life where everything just changed. And it was just later on. It was about 6 months after, where I was on holiday with my mum. A guy was filming me with his camera phone. But in fact, we normally would sit towards the back by the pole, but right at the back, so that I could at least uncover a little bit, so I could get a little bit of suntan. And this particular day, we couldn't find sun loungers, so I had to sit in front of this guy. And as I pulled my sort of sarong type dress off my shoulders, he brought up his camera phone and started to film me. I mean, to this day, I don't know whether he was actually filming me or not, but in my head, he was filming me. And I kept saying to my mum, he's filming me, I don't like this. He's horrible, he's going to put this on YouTube, I'm going to be the scarred lady. You know, I just thought all these negative things. So she said, no, stop, right, we'll go to the beach. So we went off to the beach and we sat on the sun loungers, and she began to like look at my scars, and she kept saying, does that hurt? Are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm fine, mum, I'm fine. And then I got up and I decided to make a conscious decision as I was walking down to the water's edge with my sarong tied around me. I turned around halfway and I could see my mum with her head drooped down, with her face almost down in the sand, you know, looking right down. And I just felt a unhappiness. And I thought, you know, you're a mother. Imagine all the guilt and everything that she's been through in her life. And I needed to change that. So as I walked to the water's edge, I turned around, pulled off my sarong and put my hands on my hips, and I smiled and I said, Mum, everything's okay. And then I went back to my mum and I just put my hand on her shoulder and said, you know, everything's going to be okay from now. And yeah, and we had a great holiday after that. It was amazing. So I knew at that moment on the water's edge, by putting my hand on my hip, smiling, dropping my sarong and saying, this is me. Everyone can take pictures and do whatever they want to do now. I'm going to be the happy person. So if anyone says, who is that scarred lady? They can say, well, she's smiling. So that was what was important to me and important for my mum to see that I'm happy. So that was the turning point that always gets me upset.
It's really wonderful to hear you had that experience, because so many people that have gone through what you have, they don't have that.
No.
They carry that shame with them for their entire lives. Mm. And so it's so heartening to hear that you found that strength despite all that you've been through to make that change. And from what I know from your story, you know, it's all been up from there.
Yeah,
really.
It has, yeah.
And so in a moment, we'll move on to talking about how many more positive changes you've had in your life since then. I'm interested to know, what was your mum's reaction like in that moment?
Well, when I went back to her and I put my hand on her shoulder and I just said, you know, everything's going to be okay now. She looked at me and she knew what I meant. And it was from then we had such a connection. We always were connected, because I knew that she was a great, loving mum to me. But at that moment, like, I could just feel something. It was almost like a cloud had lifted. And then we were able to just move on and have the best holiday ever. and things were just so different after that. And just talking to her now, and she loves everything about me. She's always loved everything about me, and she still calls me her baby today. And yeah, we just have been able to talk about it so much more now. I had an award ceremony that she come and supported me. She's just always been there. Yeah.
And it sounds like a really transformational moment for her as well, because she had all that guilt built up.
And
I think that's quite natural as a parent. If your child goes through anything,
you
take that on as, oh, how does this reflect on me? What could I have done more to protect them? And then actually, once you'd connected and broke down that barrier, you were able to talk a lot more openly and take away a lot of that.
I think that because I'd been spending so much time at home on the internet and trying to find support for myself and not being able to find that, I'd researched so much, and then I realised that actually families can suffer PTSD too, mm-hmm. and they can go through this as much as the person that's injured or in an accident or whatever type of trauma. And so it was important for me to realise that and help others realise that too, that families are just as important as we are, because we do get a little bit sort of disconnected with our family. And when they're trying to try and support us, and we don't want that support, we don't want that love, and we don't want to hear we're beautiful and all those kind of things. But really and truly, we got to understand that they're suffering too.
Yeah, exactly. It's that important distinction of you all coming together, because that can happen a lot in families. You're all trying to protect each other.
Yeah.
And so sometimes you shield each other from the hardest conversations, but actually, those are often the ones you most need to have to bring you all together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And certainly mental illness, whoever it's experiencing it, it grows in the darkness.
Yeah.
If it's not talked about, it just festers.
It does, yeah. And clearly that is what has been happening to me for so long. I didn't really know who I could talk to about it. Even friends, like, I don't even think my friends understood how severe everything was, because I just felt like a lot of it was going on in my head at the time, which it clearly was, but I just could not find a release for that. So I just looked at all other avenues, which were clearly not good for me, such as alcohol and all those not great things, you know. But I do wish that there was a much better support system put in place from the hospitals.
Yeah, absolutely, because it affects everyone in your life. Not being able to communicate these things for their shame also robs friends and family of the ability to support you in the way you need most.
Yeah.
If they don't know what you're experiencing, how can they adapt to best be there for you?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's great to hear that you had that realisation.
Yeah, I think so. And also my siblings, I'm the youngest child of five daughters. Mm-hmm. So I can imagine that going through that, and my mum and my dad always spending a lot of time with me, a lot of attention on me, it would have affected my other siblings. And I can see how we kind of disconnected as well as we were growing up, and all those kind of things would have happened, which is a shame. But you know, now that I'm able to recognise the person that I truly am, we have a better relationships, all of us.
Yeah. And so since then, things have gone better and better for you. So can you share a little bit of what you've been involved with since then and the work you do today?
Yeah, so when I come back off my holiday, I did a video reveal that I put on social media with the help of my cousin, and just said to him, you know, like, I've done absolutely nothing in my life. I've just suffered so much, and I just need to do something to help others. And he said, look, let's do this video. And I was a little bit like, oh, no, not sure, a bit scary, you know. And actually, it's quite a raw video, because even when I look back at it, I just think, oh, wow, was that me? I can't believe that was me. Because it was just at that moment, just after the turning point. And I cry in the video. And it's just quite, it's hard to watch for me now. But when I did launch it on Facebook, I had a lot of messages, and they were really beautiful messages of people saying I was inspirational, and I was like, what? I've never heard of this word before, especially someone telling me that I'm inspirational. And so it just absolutely was crazy at one point, because I had so many messages, and then somehow BBC World News picked up on it and they shared it online. I was absolutely shocked when I received worldwide messages from people in America and Australia and all around the world saying to me, thank you so much. Do you know I've got a skin condition? I've got scars. I've got this. And so many people that I was connecting with. And then I thought to myself, do you know what? It's not just you with scarring. There's other people that have like conditions that affect their appearance, whether it's on the face or the body. And so maybe you should help support all of them. And so I set up a Facebook group, become such a great sort of network for so many different people. And I went on to create photo shoots to challenge the fashion industry, to become more inclusive and diverse, and which I still do now. I recently just launched some photos for Mental Health Awareness Week this week, and they are absolutely brilliant, so you must check them out. Mm-hmm. And I also go out and I do sort of bikini flash mobs and get into my underwear and do Victoria's Secret campaigns that actually went viral. So I am quite a busy person. I do meetups on the beach and I just get people to come and be empowered and help each other, empower each other, and teach them how to embrace their bodies a little bit. And I've just recently also set up Love Disfigure Talks, which is for people to come and join me, and we go out and we do inspirational talks. That's just started. Yeah, so we've done quite a bit in the last 2.5 years.
Yeah, a lot of things.
Yeah. I've also received a Point of Light Award from Prime Minister Theresa May, and with a letter, signed letter, which was amazing. And a couple of other awards. So it's
it's brilliant. But it's interesting, isn't it, how you'd carried this burden for so long.
Yeah.
And because of the shame, and because the hospital were encouraging you to cover up, you'd built up so much in your mind of how you thought people would react.
Yeah.
Whereas actually when you release this burden and, you know, authentically expressed who you are.
Yeah.
The response was incredibly positive.
It was really positive, yeah. What I tried to do was make sure that Love Disfigure is to be inclusive of people of any type of condition, visible or hidden difference. You know, and covering up isn't good for us. We need to be embracing our bodies and being able to say it's okay.
And that's something I think we see a lot on the podcast in general when it comes to any kind of stigma or shame. That can, for many people, be worse than the experience, the reaction. Yeah. You know, I speak to so many people where they've held off for years and for massive chunks of their life getting support with their mental health because of the stigma, because of the shame. Yeah. They felt that they should be able to deal with it all themselves.
Yeah.
And actually, that can hold them back so often more than the mental illness.
Yeah.
And it sounds a little bit like you've had a similar experience.
Yeah.
The perception of how people would respond and the shame became bigger than the actual threat of how people respond.
Yeah, I definitely think that. I think I was scared because I always put everyone above me, and I always thought it's something, I don't know if it come from my father, but I just always felt like it's important to know that we must know as children. It's something that we were taught. There's always somebody worse off than you.
Right.
And so I've always thought that there's someone worse off than me, and I still believe that today. And so even though I have a disability, I don't like to say that I've got a disability around my friends who are in wheelchair users, you know, that because I just don't like to say that. I don't like to use the word like around them because I feel like they're still worse off than me.
I understand that, but then their experience doesn't invalidate yours either.
Yeah. I have spoken about it recently, so I am starting to open up about that.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to own your experience. I recorded another podcast just today where we talked a little bit about that a lot of my guests will bring that up, that there are people worse off than them. But then there are also people better off than you. And neither actually have a direct bearing on your life. It doesn't change the validity of your experience.
That's very true, yeah.
But it's so wonderful that you found ways to turn these experiences into an asset.
Yeah.
Something that inspires other people and also has really transformed your life and your purpose.
Yeah, I'm almost like hungry for this now, and I just want to keep going. I'm so passionate about it. I feel like it's my calling, like this is the reason that I'm a survivor, like it's the reason that I survived. And now I sit down and I think, you know, you didn't survive that for nothing. You've got to be doing something amazing in your life. Whatever it is, you need to be inspiring others now to say it's okay, like you can be something wonderful too.
Right, I love that so much. And that's very much where I come from with this podcast, that I could write off experiences of mental illness in my life as something that's unfortunate that's happened to me. But actually, instead, as part of coming to terms with them, I've learned the skills that they've given me. I've learned how I can celebrate some of my darkest times through offering something to others, offering insight, and having these difficult conversations so that we can sit here and be an example that it is possible.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that other people are increasingly safe to have these conversations around others.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think definitely younger generation need to know that we're here for them too and supportive of their needs. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and so on that nice positive note, we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for being part of the show. If people want to learn more about you, where should they go online?
To lovedisfigure.com. I'm also on Instagram, love_disfigure, and Twitter @lovedisfigure.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you again so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.